On this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke, greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're coming to you live today from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. And it is my pleasure today, and indeed a great pleasure for me to welcome as our guest, Paul Krugman. Paul Krugman is a professor of economics at Princeton University, the winner of the John Bakes Clark Medal for the best American economist under the age of 40 a few years ago. And he is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, where I think most of you as our listeners would be familiar with him. He's emerged over the past few years as really one of the most striking voices, political voices in the United States in political journalism. And he has a new book out, which I strongly recommend, The Great Unraveling, which collects many of his columns and his thoughts from the past 3 years. Addressing the political situation in the United States today, in particular looking at the economics of the United States and the policies of the Bush administration. Paul Krugman, in this book and in his writings, has emerged as arguably the leading critic in the mainstream press of the Bush administration. It is my privilege to welcome to Media Matters today Paul Krugman.
Hi there. Good morning, or good afternoon, whatever. Yes, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I think we're afternoon both places.
Afternoon, yes. Okay.
Well, The Great Unraveling refers, the subtitles, Losing Our Way in the New Century, and is a pretty much a direct critique of the Bush administration. For our listeners who are unfamiliar with your columns in the New York Times, because not all of them subscribe to the Times here, and have yet to see the book, could you just give a brief synopsis of what the argument is?
Well, the columns are telling the story of really what I learned in the course of trying to keep track of what was happening, which was that, first of all, that we had some very irresponsible people running the country, and I caught on to that fairly early, and then that they're also quite dishonest about how they sell their policies economically. And then as I went on and as I tie up together in the new material in the book, you really have to step back and ask what is really going on here, and the answer is that we have got a really radical political movement has in effect taken over the White House and Congress, and is pushing an agenda which is much more radical, much more right wing, and much more far reaching than most people are willing to acknowledge even now.
And if you don't mind saying so, what is that agenda? I mean, let me phrase it this way: the agenda we're told, or rhetorically at least, and what we hear the president say and his supporters, and I think which is mostly conveyed in the news media, is one where he wants to lower taxes on the middle class and business to spur investment and spur free enterprise and economic growth, and we all live happily ever after. You're saying that's not an accurate picture of what's taking place.
So let's talk about the economics for a moment here. There are other pieces to the story which go beyond economics. But on the economics, if you look at what the key supporters of the administration have to say, not the official, you know, the soothing pronouncements from the White House, but what the Heritage Foundation has to say, or Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Action, have to say, they're very clear. The purpose of the tax cuts is not to spur the economy, though they may, you know, have some hopes about all that, but the purpose of the tax cuts is to starve the beast, is the phrase they use. It's to deprive the federal government of the revenue it needs to maintain all of these nasty programs that they dislike. And what they dislike turns out to be, well, these people use the terms New Deal and Great Society as sort of curse words. In other words, everything Franklin Roosevelt and so on brought us, Social Security, Medicare, all of that. So basically their aim is to dismantle the social insurance programs that we've had for the past 70 years. It's a hidden agenda, not very hidden, but just not the expressed agenda. And it's the only way, actually, you can make sense of tax cuts, because in the face of ballooning budget deficits.
Yeah, what about the claims that tax cuts will stimulate the economy? As an economist, I mean, you've heard these throughout, I suspect, much of your career. It's been a common notion, going back to the Reagan tax cuts of the early 1980s, that these will have a stimulating effect. Are these a good thing for the economy?
Well, there's always something to be said for pumping money out into the economy when it's depressed. So every sensible economist thinks that it's okay to run budget deficits as a temporary thing when you have an economic slump. It's not clear that tax cuts are the best way to do that. It particularly seems that tax cuts that are aimed primarily at people with high incomes are a particularly ineffective way of doing that because they're the people least likely to spend the extra money. But all that said, we've gotten some help to the economy out of running budget deficits, out of having these tax cuts these last couple of years. I think any undergraduate student of economics could set you up a policy that would run smaller deficits and deliver more jobs, but still better this policy than none at all. The point is these are not temporary policies. They're all policies that are designed to lock in a lower amount of revenue for the federal government permanently, and there's never been any explanation of how we're going to be able to pay for Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, national defense, given that level of revenue. Actually, the best thing to say is, look, what was the central economic proposal in the State of the Union last week? It was make the tax cuts permanent. Now, that has nothing to do with helping the economy now. We're talking about provisions that are going to expire over the next 7 or so years, the way the law is written, and Bush says, well, what we need to do is make those permanent. Nobody's going to spend more money now because Congress has passed a law that says that the current tax laws will extend beyond 2010. But what it does do is it ensures, if he gets it, that we're not going to, it's going to be a tremendous political struggle to get back the revenue that we've lost later on when the baby boomers are, you know, when we need money to pay for Social Security and Medicare benefits when the baby boomers hit 65.
We're talking to Professor Paul Krugman today, the Princeton University economist and also best known as a columnist for the New York Times, which you've written for 3 or 4 years now, haven't you?
I came in with January 2000.
Okay.
Seems like a very, very long time ago.
It certainly does. And also the author of the new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century, which we've been talking about so far in the program. If you would like to call in and have a question for Professor Krugman or a comment, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455 and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Recently, former Secretary of Treasury O'Neill came out with his revelations about how policy deliberations take place in the inner sanctum of the administration. And as part of the revelations concerned the discussion of economic policy and the deficit, were you surprised by what he revealed?
Not really. It was confirmation. I mean, it's a little bit... It's more graphic. You know, now we've got the money quotes to fit what we thought. I mean, the basic revolution about economic policy is that they know that they're doing one thing and saying another. So during the 2000 campaign, candidate Bush said, the vast majority of my tax cuts go to people at the bottom of the economic spectrum, which was simply false, but the question was, was he deluding himself? And it turns out that in White House meetings, we have Bush saying, gee, haven't we already given the rich a big tax break? So he knew that he was lying, in other words.
It sounded like my daughter talking to me or something when I read that.
Yeah. There's another point where they're talking about deficits. And we have Dick Cheney saying, Reagan proved deficits don't matter. And, which is what we imagine that these guys think. They just don't care. But not long after that conversation in public, Cheney said, I'm a deficit hawk and the president is too. So what the book confirms is that, one of the things it confirms is that it really is systematic hypocrisy. That what they say and what they think are completely different. The other thing that emerges is there doesn't seem, well, this is a story again we've been hearing, that everything is political. That there are no meetings in which people say, well, what's the right thing for the country? And then somebody says, well, but, you know, politically that might cause us some difficulties. And the president says, well, let's do what's right. Everything, well, this is the Mayberry Machiavellis. Everything is just what we'll play politically, never mind.
You talk about the great unraveling and the social and political consequences of starving the beast years and decades down the road for the country. But in the short term or the medium term, the near term, say, what are the implications of these economic policies going to be for the United States economy in the next 3 to 5 years? What's your sense? I mean, are these policies that are going to have danger for just the general health of the economy?
Yeah, I think, I mean, if the rest of the world, basically if investors were just going to maintain full faith in the U.S. economy and the U.S. government until the moment when it was absolutely impossible to deny that we were going bankrupt, then we would have 10 years or so before chickens came home to roost. That's not going to happen. I think my sense now, partly from talking to business people, is that they're expecting that these guys to get serious if Bush wins re-election. You know, that all of they'll actually come to grips with the problems next year, and I think they're out of their minds. I think there's no indication that they will, and in that case, I think we're going to have a crisis of confidence in the U.S. sooner rather than later. Almost certainly not this year, but there's going to come a point. You know, there are two measures you look at for financial vulnerability. If you're, you know, let me invoke my professional economist credentials here.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the external deficit, the amount by which U.S. imports exceed exports. The other is the budget deficit. Both of those are larger relative to the size of our economy than they were, let's say, in Argentina before Argentina melted down in 2001, or larger than they were in Indonesia before Indonesia melted down in 1997. We get a lot of benefit of the doubt because we're America, and a sensible, realistic, well-run country with well-intentioned people in charge. But in fact, we're not. We're not that. That was then. That was the old America. And one of these days, the world is going to wake up to that. And at that point, it's going to be very nasty.
And when it's nasty, just for the sake of our listeners who aren't economists, what that means is that people who hold U.S. Bonds or debt will sell out. The value of the dollar might come down, which leads prices to go up, which might affect interest rates and investment and general economic health.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing, when you look at spectacular meltdowns in the third world, a lot of the way it plays out is that they have foreign debts which are in dollars, and when their currency plunges, you've got all these companies who've got assets in pesos and liabilities in dollars. Luckily, that can't happen here because our foreign debts are also in dollars. So we're not going to have that particular thing, but there's a whole bunch of other things that can happen. I was just recently in a meeting talking with some investment people, and we were all sort of hashing through. And it's quite easy to tell a story where rather quickly long-term interest rates, which are right now under 4% in the U.S., could go surging up to 8. And if you think about what that would do to bond markets, what that would do, you could have a lot of sort of random havoc sweeping through. This is more or less Robert Rubin, the Secretary of Treasury, of course, under Clinton, a couple of weeks ago issued a paper describing his concerns and saying, look, everybody says, well, look, this is the U.S. We may have long-term problems from deficits, but not crises. He says, I don't think that's right. I think that we're really exposed to something much nastier than that.
We're talking to Professor Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist and the author of the new book, The Great Unraveling, today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a full bank of phone lines, and I want to go to the callers now, and I want to thank all our callers for being so patient. Line 4, Eureka, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Mr. Krugman, I love your term, Mayberry Machiavelli.
Not mine, actually.
I like the use. It sounds very appropriate. My question is, and I guess it's fairly obvious, but it fascinates me. Had this been a Democratic president and they were running, I guess, deficits in the $400 billion range, the so-called liberal media you'd never hear the end of it. Do you think that the real purpose of this is maybe, as you were saying, to bankrupt the social programs and, you know, to gut them, as it seems to me some of the conservatives' goals are? I'll hang up and listen off here. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, let me just say about it. Some people I know actually use the term so-called liberal media. They even just say SCLM, which I think is about right.
And you've written, I think, numerous occasions in your column in the Times and in The Great Unraveling, referring to the preposterous notion that this media is hypercritical of conservatives.
Yeah, it's quite the opposite. Bush in general gets an amazing free ride. But let me just answer that question. You know, this is not hypothetical. We're not talking about some conspiracy theory based on nothing. Just go and read what the Heritage Foundation, which is basically the intellectual headquarters for the conservative movement now, has to say. Go and read what lobbyists like Norquist have to say, and they talk quite explicitly that the purpose of cutting taxes is to create a situation where we're forced to cut spending. And then if you ask where spending on what, well, the only place has to be where the money is, and that turns out to be Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. There isn't much outside that plus national defense. And so this is explicit. This is their goal. Their aim is to gut these social programs. And we're talking very serious stuff now. If you look at the size of the budget deficit and what it would take, we're really talking about 40 to 50% cuts in the major social programs, which is really would demolish them as we now understand them.
Now, Professor Krugman, this other point the caller raised, that I think is quite interesting, is that the sort of hypocrisy or the double standard with regard to how these deficits are treated, if they're generated by George W. Bush, if they're generated by, say, a liberal Democrat. I was raised in a conservative family. I remember my father railing against Democrats for running federal deficits on a budget. And this was just something that was absolutely criminal. And I wonder, where is the business community now? Why isn't the business community up in arms vocally with the deficit? Why aren't they throwing piles of money at Democratic candidates to bring fiscal sanity? And this leads, I think, to one of the themes of your book, which is that of crony capitalism.
Yeah. You have to think about two somewhat separate issues. What's actually good for business? And actually, if you look at the historical record, it's actually quite striking that the economy grows faster under Democrats. Actually, it's such a striking result that we're kind of puzzled, those of us who look at it, because we can't figure out how they did that. Right? The actual policy differences between Republicans and Democrats, while significant, don't seem to have been large enough to account for the really spectacular difference in economic performance. But you don't get a better period for business than the 8 years of the Clinton administration. But if you ask what's good for business, but what's good for individual corporate executives, then that's a kind of different story. A government that cuts taxes on the rich, that eliminates the estate tax, that in general is just very, very good for people with incomes of more than $1 million a year, that's a government that might not be so good for business, but it's pretty good for executives. All of that said, I'll give you what I believe to be true, and based partly on some conversations. A lot of corporate types who were enthusiastic about Bush, thinking that he would cut their taxes and that it wouldn't be, be basically sensible government, are now having deep second thoughts, but they're scared. It's gone so quickly that they're actually afraid of that they'll be shut out of government contracts, that they will just face intolerable pressures if they start giving to Democrats or vocally support opposition to Bush. So I think these guys thought that they were buying their guy, and now have discovered that actually they don't have very much freedom of action anymore.
We're talking to Professor Paul Krugman on Media Matters. We've got a full bank of phone lines, and I'm going to go back to the lines. If you do want to call in, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Professor Krugman is the New York Times columnist and the author of the new book, The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Line 1, New York, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Yes, hi. I'm a big fan of Mr. Krugman from New York. How are you doing today, Paul?
I'm pretty good.
Okay, here's a quick question. Based on what you were talking before about what is good for business, I'm an IT worker, and I've been watching the outsourcing trend over the last, and I've been also watching the increase in productivity and how that's affecting technology. I mean, are we heading towards a point that what's good for business may be what the opposite is good for the average American worker?
Okay.
Is there a dichotomy there, or am I missing this?
Let's put it this way. You don't want to go, it's not always true, but the whole bit about rising tide raises all boats and so on is looking very hollow right now. That really is. I mean, you can look at this. I had a piece in the Times a few weeks ago called "Our So-Called Boom." If you look at what's been happening since the summer, when a lot of the economic indicators have turned up, basically none of that has been shared with workers. Job growth has been basically pitiful. Wages are just barely keeping up with inflation, so there's really no wage growth. We're seeing a situation in which the profits are doing very, very well, finally, but doesn't affect anybody who isn't drawing his income largely from stocks. And so it's a real case where, yeah, exactly. I mean, what's good for right now, what's good for business is definitely not necessarily good for most Americans. This caps off a trend. I mean, over the past 25 years, there's been a huge divergence between middle-income Americans who have just barely made progress and a relatively small number of people who derive their income from corporate positions or otherwise in privileged positions, who have done spectacularly well. And that trend seems to be accelerating right now.
Are they in danger of killing the golden calf?
I mean, that's a question. How long can you run an economy in which, look, you look at the Christmas season, it was really amazing. Stores that catered to ordinary working families had okay Christmas sales, up a few percent over last year. Luxury places, Tiffany's, had double-digit growth in sales. Now, you know, can you build an economy on sales of at Tiffany's and the Sharper Image? And we had, you know, history suggests probably not for the long run, but it may be a while before the reckoning comes.
Not to mention the social question: do you want to build such an economy?
Well, that's a very different thing. And the question is: I kind of like living in a middle class society, I used to like living in a middle class society, and we less and less do we have one.
We're talking to Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist today, and the author of the new book, The Great Unraveling. Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Let's talk about liberal columnists for a second. Thomas Friedman in the Times this morning argued that the problem in the Arab world is basically jobs, and the problem is that we can't export jobs to them the way we export jobs to places like China, and that we've been a smashing success, NAFTA has been a smashing success in this hemisphere for Mexico, and Europe should do the same thing for the Arab world that the United States has done for Mexico under NAFTA. This is a liberal analysis of the problem here. I think it's completely out of touch with reality. I'd like to know what you think of it.
Okay, well, let me say, I was a NAFTA supporter. I still think it was better that we did it than not. But it has been a disappointment. Mexico is not a smashing success. I mean, Mexico, they had a genuine democratic election, which was a good thing, and they're probably better off than they would be if we hadn't given them, if we hadn't made that deal, but it's not a great thing. And I have to say, the reasons why we're not going to turn the Middle East into into another China run pretty deep, and it's not something that the Europeans can solve quickly. I don't know. I just there are levels and levels of liberalism, I guess. But in general, I'm mostly pro globalization, and that's a point of difference with some people who are now very much my political allies in terms of what's going on now, and I think we've kind of reached an agreement that this is not, given what's happened to our own country, this is not the core issue to fight over right now. But I'm certainly not a Pollyanna on that, and I don't think that you can talk about what's happening now in the Middle East and say, well, what we need is East Asian style economic growth, is a little bit like saying what we need is for a fairy godmother to come and magically make us all rich. It's going to be generations away if it can happen at all.
Professor Krugman, you've written quite a bit about the Iraq War.
Yeah.
And, I mean, in your memory, I mean, given the reasons that were stated for this war, and there seem to be parallels to the economic policy where there are sort of stated reasons and there are real reasons.
Yeah. I was originally hired by the Times to write primarily about economics and business, and I was really reluctant to even get into all this, but during last fall, not this past fall, but the fall of 2002, when the case for war was being pushed, I just couldn't help noticing that it looked and sounded just like the way they were selling the tax cuts. The same sliding over the facts, the same use of misleading rhetoric, the same sort of shouting down of questions. And I said, you know, I think they're lying again. I think that they're going to do that, that they're misleading us into war just the way they misled us into the economic policies. And so I came out pretty strongly against this thing. I have to say that I thought we'd find at least some chemical weapons. I thought that the big sin was mislabeling poison gas, which is horrible stuff, but is not really a weapon of mass destruction. That they were blurring the line between truly scary stuff, of which there was no evidence, and stuff that was evil and nasty. But as it turned out, of course, that the case for war has proved to be false beyond my most pessimistic expectations. So it's all a piece. And the neocon foreign policy types are playing a role very similar to the hardline right-wing Star of the Beasters in determining administration policy.
Well, what is to follow that comparison further, we understand the logic of the Star of the Beasters. They want to gut the so-called welfare state, the social services of the federal government and probably other governments. What is the real objective of the neocons guiding this policy? Where do they want to see the world look like?
Well, they want to see essentially a militarized foreign policy with the U.S. using a doctrine of preemptive war, and with particularly in the Middle East, but more broadly, their vision was one of the U.S. throwing its weight around. In their view, I think all of these people imagine that it's all for the greater good. But in their view, it's all about the world will be a safer place if everybody out there is terrified that the U.S. may be coming, the U.S. will come and invade them if they don't behave. And Iraq was, clearly what Iraq was really about was not a perceived threat. I think they hyped that. They convinced themselves that there would be enough to justify it, but it was about a pilot project for this new foreign policy. We would just show, you know, we could roll in, we could overwhelm anybody's army in a few days, which is true. And we can install our favorite people in charge and move out, and everything will be happy, which turns out to be totally false. And the pilot project didn't go too well, and now they're scrambling.
We're talking to Professor Paul Krugman. We've got a full bank of phone lines here in Media Matters, so let's get back to the phones. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Yes, thank you. Given, you know, the way you're projecting things are going to go, and I guess the scary scenario of Bush getting reelected, what kind of advice would you give someone who's trying to invest for their retirement and has, you know, like a 15-year timeline? I mean, is there any hope of, protecting yourself against this?
This is a really good question, and I don't think bonds are a good idea because I think interest rates are going to soar one of these days. I don't think stocks are a good idea because of knock-on effects from that. It's kind of hard. I mean, unfortunately, if you'd asked me 6 months or a year ago, I would have told you, for all its problems, I'd say euros were a pretty good investment, and now you think I was a genius, we've kind of passed that point. These days, actually, we sometimes say, well, you know, is there any other planet we can invest on? because it's not only the United States that has problems. It's a little tricky. I mean, what can you say? Cash is good for now, but it won't, eventually there may be the return of inflation. It's kind of hard. I don't have great advice. I don't see a brilliant yielding asset out there.
I guess also, I'm just wondering, I mean, do these people, you know, the neocons, really think that, you know, maybe they don't think they're going to bankrupt the country, I don't know, but, I mean, it seems like they're sowing the seeds for, and maybe revolution's too strong a word, but I'd have to believe that a lot of people are going to be very angry and, you know, that things are going to, the pendulum's going to swing back in the other direction politically.
Well, I think I think that the people actually in the White House are just catering to the base, and they really aren't thinking very much about what's going to happen in 5 years. I don't think they're actually thinking about what's going to happen in 11 months. They only have to get through the next 10. The people, the architects of all this, the ideologues, their vision is of a situation in which there's extreme pressure on the budget, and they get to push through these big cuts in social programs. And I suspect that in the end they're going to find that they screwed up badly, even from their own point of view. That in the end people are going to say, hey, wait a second, this is not what we want, and that there will be a kind of public uprising against that kind of backward step. In you know, they want to bring us back to the 20s or before. I mean, the ever quotable Grover Norquist was asked whether he wanted to bring us back to the way we were before the New Deal, and he said, no, I want to go back to the way it was before the progressive movement. So he wants to bring us back to the 1890s.
Or before the Civil War.
Well, there are some people who want that too, yes. I think that they're wrong. I think what they'll actually eventually do is they'll actually create a new Franklin Roosevelt. But it may be, it's going to be a while before we get there.
Yeah, what is your sense of the 2004 presidential election, both in terms of its importance and what could possibly happen?
Well, I think it's incredibly important. I mean, the thing to say is that it's not just, well, you know, 2004, but if then there'll be another one in 2008. We've already seen in a whole series of things, Texas redistricting, the way that they're handling campaign finance, that I'll quote Molly Ivins, who said that these people don't want to govern, they want to rule. Or Bob Kuttner has said that they really are seeking a one-party state. And I think that's right, that if Bush wins and the Republicans retain control of Congress, there's going to be a tremendous effort to lock in a permanent political advantage. So this election I'm not sure. I mean, if you were a real cynic and a pessimist, you would say 2004 isn't a crucial election. That already happened. But I think the election is still up for grabs. And it's terribly crucial.
Do you have any candidate that you personally are warm to among the Democratic contenders?
I can't do that.
Okay.
Times rules. I mean, in fact, in principle, I'm nonpartisan. New York Times rules, you have no more, you know, I'm as, my political sympathies are as secret as those of William Safire. My sense is that a candidate, in order, how am I supposed to say this? On the actual policy content,
mm-hmm.
Let's say that the four who actually seem to have some chance of getting it, would be Dean Clark, Kerry Edwards, there's not a lot of difference in terms of what they're actually advocating. I mean, yes, there are details and so on, but fundamentally they're all, much less right-wing than the administration. They all want to roll back tax cuts, at least at the top end, and so on. None of them, whatever differences they may have had over Iraq, I think none of them subscribes to the doctrine of preemptive war. So there's not a lot of difference. There's a question about what works for a campaign, and I guess the question is, my belief is that it has to be fought as a tough challenge to what's going on. That someone who instinctively shies away from confrontation is not going to have any chance in this election. And that I was kind of writing off Kerry wrongly not long ago because it didn't seem as if he was tough enough. But maybe that's all wrong.
Yeah, so primarily if they're basically not interchangeable, very compatible in terms of policy.
Yeah, they're different people.
The criteria is which one's going to have the best shot of winning.
Yeah, and the answer is I have no idea. Okay. I mean, I'm not a real political pundit. I don't have any expertise. I read the real political pundits, find out what they all agree on, and then we know that's not going to happen.
Take the opposite route, contrarian.
Yeah.
We're talking to Paul Krugman, the New York Times columnist, the economist, and the author of the new book, The Great Unraveling, today on Media Matters. We've got a full bank of phone lines, and I want to thank all the callers for being patient. I'm about to go back to the lines. First, let me announce some of the guests coming on the upcoming shows. Next week, we continue our parade of economists with Bob Poland, the UMass economist, with his new book on Clinton and Bush economics. 2-3 weeks from today, we have Al Franken on talking about politics, as usual, and his new campaign, his new program, we'll be doing drug-free talk radio. 4 weeks from today, Ben Scott talking about what's going on in Capitol Hill with the media ownership rules. And 5 weeks from today, Molly Ivins, the great newspaper columnist who Paul Krugman just referred to, will be our guest here on Media Matters. Let's go back to the phone lines right now, and we're going to go to line 4, Charleston. You're on the air with Professor Paul Krugman.
Hello. Thank you very much for this opportunity. It's an honor. Two words come to mind from previous comments, and that robber barons. And I want to say that the dictum, follow the money, could be translated to follow the tax dollars, where tax dollars are being removed from taxpayers' pockets along with their jobs, going into the coffers of the extremely wealthy. And I think this is much more extensive than gutting the welfare state to, I think, in fact, that there is an active, you called it a radical, or somebody did, a radical activist administration and their friends. I think it's much more to the point of creating a two-class state in the United States, an active and deliberate elimination of the middle class that will result in an extremely wealthy, powerful overclass and a peasant class, which will be desperate for jobs and will work under any conditions for any amount. And the most cynical comment was Bush's State of the Union speech, in which he's proposing training. For what jobs would this be? Do you want to move to China, India, Mexico for these jobs? Combine the tax policy, the rapid moving of jobs away, a diminution of our citizen rights, and constant war or constant fear, and I think the aim is to make the U.S. as much like the third world as possible to support the real beast, which is this extremely wealthy, powerful overclass. I say all this at the risk of being a cynical pessimist, possibly paranoid.
Well, what do I say? I think it, you know, there's always a question of what are the right words to use, I think. And I often say that there's a lot of Latin American parallels that fit for what's going on here. And we don't have to decide whether they're actually consciously trying to turn the United States into a Central American country or not, to say that, look, at least they're pushing us substantially in that direction. And it's, one of the things interesting, by the way, is that my version of this would be to say that our current ruling coalition talks a lot about free enterprise, free markets. But if you actually look at the policies, that's not what they favor. There are a lot of CEOs in this administration. Not one of them is a CEO of a company that actually just sort of competes in the free market. They're all companies that depend upon government favors. Mm-hmm. And I think the robber barons is slightly unfair to the robber barons because they were actually mostly seeking monopolies, but the crony capitalist is the right word. Mm-hmm. And this really is a crony capitalist administration. Mm-hmm. And it's, how far they've thought it through, I don't know. Doesn't matter. The point is that's the direction that they're pushing us, and let's see if it can be stopped.
I'm surprised that the charge of anger gets thrown at Howard Dean. I keep waiting for people whose tax dollars are going to fund the loss of their own jobs to actually get angry at some point.
There's coming back to the so-called liberal media. One of the interesting things is that how quick the charge of hatred or anger is thrown at people who are challenging, and how little of it, how much you can get away with on the right, and nobody makes a fuss. So again, Grover Norquist, tax lobbyist, works closely with the administration and with Republican leadership in Congress. He's the one who said that, who compared the estate tax to the Holocaust. And more recently he said, well, you know, the Nazis had progressive taxes. And Nobody seems to think that that's an issue worth mentioning. But if some marginal person on the left does a comparison, wow.
Yeah, that's extraordinary. You know, I have a friend who's been doing an analysis of the Bush administration, writing a book on it, and he makes the argument, the book's not yet published, that really there are tremendous parallels between the sort of Bush economics and this crony capitalism you describe and the sort of classical fascism of Mussolini. And I think fascism sort of took a turn under Hitler, thinking of genocide and foreign conquest.
I don't know. That's, you know, using the fascist thing gets you offers a big target for people. I think you want to. I mean, if there were comparisons, well, for what it's worth, I think crony capitalism is the best comparison. And the term crony capitalist actually comes from the Philippines, from the Marcos years.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to. Bush is not as bad as Marcos, at least not yet. But there are better parallels there than anything else.
Yeah. We're talking to Paul Krugman today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have, again, a full bank of phone lines, and I want to get all our callers in before we go off the air. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Yeah, I have a request and a question. The request is, I've heard in a couple different situations, one in particular, a Social Security Administration bureaucrat mentioned that that there's a huge amount of payroll contributions sitting in the so-called Social Security Trust Fund attributable to illegal aliens using, for example, false Social Security numbers. And he gave a number a year ago about $340 billion. Then again, I heard it was $370 billion with a B. And I think that would be a really important fact for somebody like the New York Times to investigate and look into. But here's a question, and that is: you implied earlier that the rise of the euro may be coming to its peak, and but we still have low interest rates, and. This is kind of a bad question. I haven't really that well formulated, but I wanted to tie in this news item I read and it fell flat, didn't go anywhere, didn't have any legs at all, about 47 currency traders being arrested in New York, including people from J.P. Morgan and UBS AG. And so my question really has to do about, in general, what's going on with the dollar versus the euro in particular. I'm kind of interested about that. I personally would like to see the euro get more powerful, and I'm wondering if there is, in fact, a real battle there between the two. And I'll hang up and I'll listen.
Yeah, I'm going to punt on the first one because I haven't done my homework on Social Security and illegal aliens. Those numbers sound high to me, but I could be I should punt on it. Yeah, the dollar, the euro, the basic thing is the U.S. has been relying on enormous inflows of money from the rest of the world. It began a lot in the 90s when the U.S. economy was doing extremely well and people wanted to buy into America. But more recently, a lot of it has been central banks, has been essentially the monetary authorities of Japan and China buying dollars in an attempt to keep their own currencies from rising, and this can't go on. And you actually try to figure out what's sustainable, and you say, well, the U.S. has got to cut its current account deficit to well under half what it is right now. And to do that, the dollar has to fall a lot. And my back of the envelope is that the dollar has to fall about from where it was as of a year ago, has to fall like more than 30% against, on average, against the world's currencies. And I think it actually has fallen about that much against the euro. But it hasn't fallen much at all against Asian currencies. So it's. I think the dollar euro rate may well have reached where it's going to go, but the dollar yen, dollar yuan, and so on are has still got a ways to go. The limit, the problem with the Europeans is that their economy is also weak. They're also having problems with with jobs, and a strong euro doesn't help. It makes their products less competitive. So that kind of puts a cap on how high the euro can go. This is relatively non-political. I think all of this would have been happening, whoever was in charge. But anyway, and I can quickly turn this into an hour and a half economics lecture. I better stop myself now.
Okay, we're talking to Paul Krugman, the Princeton economist and the New York Times columnist, and author of the new book, The Great Unraveling, today in Media Matters. We have a full bank of phone calls, and we've only got a few minutes left, so I'll try to get through these calls quickly. Line 3, Lansing, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
Is that me?
That's you.
Hi. I was wanting to ask Mr. Krugman, Gore Vidal has been preaching for decades that the only hope for our democracy is a slashing of the military budget, and I wanted to ask him what his opinion was about that and what he thought the possibility was that someone like Kucinich could come to power and achieve such a slashing of the military budget as opposed to cutting social spending. And I'll hang up and listen to his answer. Thank you.
Okay, just to say, the military budget, there's a lot of waste in there. But military budget's around 4% of gross domestic product now. Just given the kinds of things the U.S. needs to do in the world on a routine basis, it's hard to see it going much below 3. So it's like $100 billion, which is a small fraction of our budget deficit. If you could manage to cut it, as right now, given what we've done and given the strains in Iraq, actually the military is desperately short of manpower. So it's not a big thing. And I guess we really should be asking about clearly off kilter programs like missile defense. But I just don't think it's realistic to imagine that we're going to solve all our problems by diverting money away from the military.
Are you concerned about the political issue of having an extraordinarily powerful military, though, in the United States? Chalmers Johnson, historian, and there's a new book out in which, he doesn't, I don't think necessarily uses the term Algeria in France, but he, says we should have real concerns about having this extraordinarily powerful military that really is only loosely under any sort of civilian control.
Yeah, it does. There are disturbing things. I've got Chalmers' book sitting here on the gotta read immediately pile, but it's disturbing. We have a number of people have pointed out that we have a military whose culture has become increasingly different, particularly among the officers, very different from that of the nation as a whole. We have an officer class that. There was a time when the officers thought that they should try to be non-political. Now it's very, very heavily Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And, you don't have to go very far to start having lurid fantasies there.
Mm-hmm.
But as my understanding is, actually senior officers, at least, in the military are extremely unhappy with what's going on. If anything, I think if you took a vote among people, colonel and up in the military, and they knew it was a secret ballot, they would call for booting out the current administration in a heartbeat.
Okay, we're talking to Paul Krugman today. We've only got a few minutes left. Let's get back to the phone lines. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Professor Krugman.
Yeah, good afternoon. I've heard a lot I agree with here. I just wanted to make a comment about Texas, and you mentioned the redistricting. I think we've got a president, a vice president, and Tom DeLay there. I think Tom DeLay controls the House of Representatives, and just a comment on a geographical place having so much power, and I'll get off my comment. Thank you.
Yeah, we got a lot of Texans, I know. So I've seen the bumper sticker, isn't it? Read my lips, no new Texans. But the funny thing is that Texas itself is changing. And part of what's going on in Texas is that it's an attempt of the traditional Texas hierarchy to lock in its position of power within the state against demographics that are shifting it very much away from that. And Texas, left to the natural course of events, is actually going the way of California. It's a one-time right-wing place that with a growing Latino population, just growing sophistication, is wanting to go the other way. So 10-15 years from now, Texas may be a place that politically would feel quite comfortable for somebody like me, but not now anyway.
Okay, let's go back to the phone lines. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Paul Krugman. Hello. I guess...
Line 4?
No, whatever line you are, you're on the air with Paul Krugman.
I think most people don't know why it's important to balance the budget, namely that the U.S., like an individual, has to pay interest, and that at one point was the second biggest outgo in the U.S. budget. And I hear the Democrats talking about fiscal responsibility, but I think they also need to explain why this is an important thing. And I will hang up and let you say so.
Yeah, and let me say, what's particularly the case here is we've got the domestic budget of the U.S. One description of the federal government I've seen, which is, I think, terrific, is that it's a giant insurance company with a side business in national defense. And the dominant programs are Social Security and Medicare. And guess what? Us baby boomers are getting older, and we're going to be placing claims on those systems in about 7 years now, if this, if the leading edge will hit. And it's if we have to pay for those programs and pay interest on a huge debt, then it's going to be very, very hard. It's not clear how you know, it would require a huge tax increase at that point to pay for what's coming. So now is the time when we should be paying down debt frantically. And the fact that we're instead building it up at the rate of $400 billion a year is just wildly irresponsible and is setting us up for a crisis.
And whoever is going to be in power then, at some point, there's no way around this crisis.
That's right. So, well, you know, there's a big difference. I think we get a lot more breathing room if the next president actually shows some signs of moving in a sensible direction. I think that the markets will get a lot more forbearant if there's a president who says, okay, well, look, we need to roll back some of those tax cuts. We need to look at expenses seriously. Then if we have a president who says, gee, we've got a huge budget deficit, we've got a war that is going on and seems to be absorbing ever more money, so the answer is let's go to Mars.
Well, we've only got a few seconds left, Professor Krugman. We've got one more caller. Line 2, very quickly, do you have a question? Or?
Well, I just had a quick comment, and I wondered if you'd have time to comment on, I wonder if problems may be, some of the problems may be hidden today because of people's use of credit, and that might hide some of the real problems that might come up in the future for the middle class.
Yes, no question. I mean, if you look at this consumer spending that's powering whatever recovery we're having, it's a huge, you know, consumer debt is at record levels, and among the four or five ways that it can all go smash is that consumer debt just suddenly people just can't do it anymore.
Professor Krugman, I hear the band tuning up. That means they need me out of the studio.
Okay.
I want to thank Paul Krugman, my guest today, the New York Times columnist, the author of the new book, The Great Unraveling, for joining me in Media Matters. I'll be back a week from today with Bob Polin. I'm Bob McChesney. See you then. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Mall in Urbana. Lincoln Square Mall is home to more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Art Mart, Art Mart Toys, and Callaway Clothing.
A winter storm warning remains in effect until midnight for central Illinois. Snow will rapidly overspread the region this afternoon. The snow may mix with sleet at times, and it will continue the remainder of the day. Strong east winds at 20 to 30 miles per hour will combine with the snowfall to create near whiteout conditions at times. Roadways will rapidly become treacherous, with conditions only becoming worse as the afternoon progresses. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, freezing rain likely, then a chance of light freezing rain and light snow, and a chance of light sleet after midnight. Additional snow accumulation up to 2 inches. The low in the mid-20s with east winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. This is WILL Urbana. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.